funds and the undermining of UK property funds, you could be in court for years.
Well, it's not. I mean, yes, some of them invest in property, as you mentioned at the end there, which are also producing.
I mean undermining property rights. My mistake.
It's the opposite. Ultimately, Andrew, this is all taxpayer backed, and of course, it would require primary legislation. But it actually gives the pensioner benefit, the entitlement holders, the pensioners. It actually protects them to a much greater degree because it would be national taxpayer backed. But I repeat the point: these are council pension funds that are backed by the taxpayer, okay? They are not private individual funds. So this language that you're using about raiding or taking is completely misleading and wrong.
And that was Richard Tice. And that's it for me today. Ayesha Hazarika will be here from 1 o'clock tomorrow on The Times at One next week. It's Trevor Phillips. But coming up now on Times Radio, Jane Garvey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Andrew, and good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio. Until four, the Prime Minister is giving an update on Iran very shortly. We'll bring you that live here on Times Radio. I'll also talk to the Times' Richard Spencer, who is on the border between Iran and Turkey. I'll talk to Helen Rumbelow about her important reporting on the linked worlds of toxic masculinity, Epstein and pornography. Vassos Alexander will be here explaining why Arsenal are once again dull, dull, dull. And our big guest is the BAFTA-winning director whose film This Is Endometriosis took home the best short film gong last month. And it's the last ever Proud as a Peacock Awards with Wix. Get in touch, tell us what's made you proud this week. You could win a £250 Wix voucher. Here's the news at 2, James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The Defence Secretary says the friendship between Britain and Cyprus is strong in the face of Iranian threats. John Healey's met with his Cypriot counterpart after a British airbase on the Mediterranean island was hit by a drone. The government's facing growing pressure over its response to the crisis in the Middle East. There are currently no Royal Navy ships in the region. The destroyer HMS Dragon will take up to a week to reach Cyprus after being deployed days after the conflict began. The Times' defence editor, Larissa Brown, is on the island.
This drone, we were initially told, had hit the runway at the base, but actually now it emerges that it had hit a hangar, and this inside the hangar were two US spy planes that aren't really talked about much, but they are there, and they've been flying, my understanding, as part of Operation Epic Fury. They've been carrying out reconnaissance missions.
A US oil tanker's reportedly on fire in the Persian Gulf as Israel and Iran continue to exchange missile fire. Explosions have been heard across Tehran on the sixth day of US-Israeli strikes. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, the IDF has told residents in southern parts of Beirut to save their lives and evacuate their homes immediately. The Foreign Office Minister Hamish Faulkner has told MPs the RAF has been actively disrupting threats in the region, including shooting down drones over Qatar. He also confirmed a delayed charter rescue flight bringing Britain's home from the Middle East will depart Oman imminently. A technical issue at Muscat Airport is being blamed for the holdup. More than 2,000 people returned on 8 commercial flights from the UAE yesterday. Mr. Faulkner told MPs there'll be further flights from both countries.
We're tackling a consular challenge on a scale not seen since COVID. There are no instant solutions for moving such numbers of people, especially while airspace restrictions remain in place. But I am determined that people get home as safely and as swiftly as possible.
The Home Secretary is proposing seismic changes to the immigration system, which will see some families offered up to £40,000 to leave the UK. Accommodation and financial support will be removed from asylum seekers who are caught working illegally under a new conditional offer of support. Another proposal is to remove study visas from migrants from 4 countries where abuse is prevalent. The Labour peer Alf Dubs arrived in Britain as a child fleeing Nazi persecution. Speaking to Times Radio, he described Shabana Mahmood's approach as disappointing.
Some of the proposals will leave people destitute and will leave them sleeping on the streets. If it is safe for somebody to go back and they're giving them money as an incentive, provided it is really safe, then okay. But I'm worried that there are people who will fall foul of the system under the measures you proposed today, and they will simply become destitute.
A shoplifter who killed a supermarket security guard while trying to flee with stolen alcohol has been jailed for more than 5 years. 61-year-old Alan Harris Richards suffered a heart attack after attempting to stop Natasha Smith leaving the Asda superstore in Angus in 2024. The judge told the 38-year-old she must bear responsibility. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
And let's cross to Downing Street. Here is Keir Starmer.
This morning I chaired another COBRA meeting as we continue to coordinate our response to the situation in Iran and the Middle East. I know that people are worried sick about their family and friends who are caught up in this, about the impact on our lives and our economy, and about the potential for even greater escalation. They can hardly believe that yet again we're seeing missiles and drones falling and civilians in the firing line across the region. So I want to reassure the British public about the action that we're taking. While the region has been plunged into chaos, my focus is providing calm, level-headed leadership in the national interest. That means deploying our military and diplomatic strength to protect our people. And it means having the strength to stand firm by our values and our principles, no matter the pressure to do otherwise. The long-standing British position is that the best way forward for the regime and the world is a negotiated settlement with Iran where they give up their nuclear ambitions. Now, that's why I took the decision that the UK would not join the initial strikes on Iran by the US and Israel. Now, that decision was deliberate. It was in the national interest. And I stand by it. But when Iran started attacking countries around the Gulf and the wider region, the situation changed. Iran has now fired drones and missiles at 10 countries that did not attack them. These are allies of the UK, where we have hundreds of thousands of British people, as well as British military personnel. Our number one priority is protecting our people. And that's why, long before the US and Israeli action last weekend, we had already deployed additional military capabilities to the region to defend our interests. And I want to pay tribute to our brilliant armed forces. Throughout January and February, we were moving defensive assets to Cyprus and Qatar. Fighter jets, air defence missiles, advanced radar and systems to take down drones. To ensure we were in a heightened state of readiness in advance of any conflict beginning. When the strikes began on Saturday, we immediately put those jets into the sky on a mission to protect our people and our allies in the region. And that is what they have done, flying over Cyprus and the wider region, shooting down multiple drones, at least one of which was heading towards a base housing British military personnel. Our jets were in the sky again last night, over Jordan, Qatar and other partners, refueling in the air to prolong their mission. And we're constantly resupplying our jets and our missile stores. And we are responding to requests from allies in the region for further help. I can announce today that we're sending 4 additional Typhoon jets to join our squadron in Qatar, to strengthen our defensive operations in Qatar and across the region. Wildcat helicopters with anti-drone capabilities are arriving in Cyprus tomorrow. The Defence Secretary is on the ground in Cyprus right now, coordinating our work and meeting our brave servicemen and women. We're deploying HMS Dragon to the Mediterranean. And we have allowed the US to use British bases to conduct defensive operations to take out Iranian missiles before they're fired at our people and our allies. We will maintain this shield over British people in the region and our allies. We are working to strengthen it every day. And we're working as fast as possible to get our people out. As of today, over 140,000 individuals in the region have registered their presence, enabling us to get them the information and the support that they need. We have rapid deployment teams on the ground in Oman and Saudi Arabia. And our consular teams are helping hundreds of the most vulnerable individuals. Despite airspace closures, we're working around the clock with airlines, travel companies, and governments to open safe routes home. More than 4,000 people have now arrived back in the United Kingdom on commercial flights from the UAE, including vulnerable Brits identified by our teams. A further 7 flights are due to leave the UAE for the UK today. And I can report that our first charter flight from Oman took off a few minutes ago. We will lay on additional charter flights in the coming days. British Airways is putting on daily flights from Oman, and we will keep working with all of our partners to increase the speed and capacity of this airlift. I want to be very clear. This is a huge undertaking. It's one of the biggest operations of its kind, many times bigger than the evacuation from Afghanistan. It's not going to happen overnight, but we will not stop until our people are safe. I also want to say a word about the economic impact. Iran is targeting oil and gas facilities in the Gulf and tankers in the Straits of Hormuz, trying to inflict economic pain around the world. So we will continue to work with the industries affected and our allies to respond to any impact. And this is where the long-term changes that we're delivering for the British people are paying off. We have the right plan for defence, delivering the biggest increase in defence spending since the Cold War, to strengthen our armed forces and keep people safe. We have the right plan for our economy. As the Chancellor said on Tuesday, we're sticking to that plan so we can cut energy bills and help keeping families with the cost of living and helping them. We also have the right plan for our energy supplies, building up clean British energy like never before, decreasing our dependence on volatile international markets and creating the energy security and independence that we need. Faced with this new geopolitical crisis, the sad fact is that some will try to use it to divide us. That's why the government is reaching out to communities across the United Kingdom, Jewish and Muslim alike, making sure that communities and places of worship have appropriate protective security in place. But look, as a nation, we should come together in this moment. Those citizens that are stuck in the region, scared and in need of help, come from all backgrounds. the armed forces who protect them, come from all backgrounds too. We are united by our common humanity and our love of this country. This conflict could continue for some time. So I want you to know that your government is resolute in our response, at home and abroad. We will do everything we can to protect British lives, uphold British values, and safeguard the national interest. Thank you. And now I'll take some questions. And I've got Chris, BBC, first, please.
Thank you, Prime Minister. Chris Wason at BBC News. Can you address directly those at home and abroad who see your response and see indecision, prevarication and a lack of preparedness? Thank you.
Yes, let me address that, because, as I said a moment ago, we started pre-deploying to the region in January and February, particularly to Cyprus and Qatar, and that was fighter jets, air defence missiles, advanced radar and anti-drone systems. Now, we did that during the course of 8 or so weeks. We did that in conjunction with the US and with our allies. We continue to bolster the capability that we have there to keep our people safe. So there's been a lot of pre-planning gone into this, a lot of pre-deployment that's gone into this, and I'm satisfied that we can keep our people safe, and we're working very hard to make sure that wherever people have registered their presence, we can help them with the information that they need and the support they need and get them back to the United Kingdom as quickly and as safely as possible. Thank you, Chris. Robert Peston, ITV.
Robert Peston, ITV. Prime Minister, I was very struck by your choice of words. You said that you stand by what you called your initial decision not to join the offensive operations of Israel and America against Iran. Does that mean that decision is subject to review? You're concentrating at the moment on defensive military activity, but could it turn into offensive activity?
Well, as you will understand, we're working with our allies and with the US on this. We've been doing that for some time. The pre-deployment was done in conjunction and in discussion with our allies and with the US. And we have that capacity in the region that we pre-deploy to the region, and we're bolstering that in the way that I've set out today. The US are using the bases to do these strikes into Iran to take out the capability to launch the strikes in the first place. So that is the configuration, that is the understanding and arrangements that we've got in place. Thank you, Robert. Beth, can I come to you?
Oh, thank you. Prime Minister, this escalating war is really frightening people that are watching today. President Trump says it will go on for 4 to 5 weeks. You've just said it will be some time. Do you have any sense of how long it could go on for? Do you agree with President Trump? What's your message to the British people worried about how it's going to affect their lives? Can you give them any reassurance that you'll help them on energy prices? And just secondly, on military operations, there's much unhappiness that military personnel and their families were left unprotected on the Cyprus airbase that was struck at the weekend. What went wrong? And do you apologise to them? Thank you.
Well, Beth, let me set out my number one message, which is that our absolute priority is the safety of our citizens. And that is the focus for all the decisions that I have taken, including the decisions to pre-deploy in the way that I've described, and the decisions we're taking every day in order to deal with the situation on the ground in the region, the consular work to get people safely back home, and also what we're doing within the country, obviously, in relation to the division that can arise in situations like this. In relation to Cyprus, we've obviously had an airbase there for a very long time. There are protective measures in place, have always been in place. It's always been a protected airbase. It's not something new to protect the airbase. We pre-deployed further assets to Cyprus in January and February for that purpose, and we're bolstering that. So I want to be really clear to everybody in Cyprus that we're taking every measure that is needed to protect them, to protect the airbase, along with the other places in the region. Thank you very much, Beth.
Do you think it will go on?
Oh, I'm sorry. In relation to how long it will go on, I do know people are worried. They are going to be worried about the any escalation. I think they can see what's unfolding on their television screens. That will cause them anxiety, understandably. They will be worried about the impact on their own lives that this could have, and those with family and friends in the region will be extremely worried about their family and friends in the region. I absolutely understand that. We are doing everything we can to de-escalate this. I can't give you a time base for this. I don't think anybody can. My strong view is that we need to de-escalate, and ultimately this will have to be a matter of negotiation when it comes to some of the core issues like nuclear capability. Thank you, Beth. Paul McNamara, Channel 4. Paul.
Afternoon, Prime Minister. There are reports that you walked into a meeting, the National Security Council, on Friday with one opinion and had your mind changed by Ed Miliband and others in your cabinet. So is it true that you wanted on Friday to give Americans a precautionary permission in the event of Iranian reprisals to use British bases for defensive action, but had your mind changed by Ed Miliband and other members of your cabinet?
Let me be really clear about this. No request from the US came in the specific terms that we acceded until Saturday afternoon. Saturday afternoon. Well, just hear me out. And therefore, on Friday, there was no concrete decision to be made. The decision had to be made when we had the request. That came in on Saturday during the course of the afternoon. We're already taking measures in relation to our own capability. That came in on Saturday afternoon, late in the afternoon. We then, as you would have expected, went through the details with the US over the next day and ultimately reached a decision on Sunday, which I announced then on Sunday evening about 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening. But actually on Friday, we didn't have a request from the United States and therefore no decision fell to be made. The decision fell to be made when we had the request. That was Saturday afternoon. We then worked it through. Decision on Sunday, which was a decision of all ministers, unanimous, that we should take the action that I then announced. Thank you very much indeed. Catherine from GB News.
Thank you, Catherine Forster, GB News. Prime Minister, Cyprus, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates and others are being critical of the speed of our response. Have we let our allies and our own people down in the Middle East? We've still got a warship sitting in Portsmouth. And also, you said yesterday how in Munich you said we need to go further and faster on defence spending. But getting to 3%, let alone 3.5%, seems to have been kicked way, way into the long grass. When is your rhetoric actually going to be matched by the reality of when you're putting money into defence?
Yeah, thank you, Catherine. I know you'll have heard me said a moment ago, we started pre-deploying in January and February our assets to the region to make sure that we had the capability that we needed there. That wasn't an isolated set of decisions. It was done in conjunction with the US, in conjunction with our allies, and we're bolstering that again. And therefore, I can say we're doing everything and have done everything we can at speed to make sure that we are properly protecting our citizens, which was my number one concern. And that's why it's very important that I set out the pre-deployment measures that we took. Can I also say on defence spend, we've obviously already increased our defence spend, with the highest spending now on defence since the Cold War. And I've set out when I was at NATO summit last year and at Munich this year that we need to go further and faster, and that's what we'll do. Thank you very much, Catherine. I've got Stephen from The Times. Stephen.
Prime Minister, Donald Trump has suggested that you've ruined the special relationship, that you are no Churchill. On the special relationship, is he right on that? Have you ruined the special relationship?
Look, the special relationship is in operation right now. We're working with the Americans in the deployment from our bases. We are working together in the region. The US and the British working together to protect both the US and the British in joint bases where we're jointly located, and we're sharing intelligence on 24/7 basis in the usual way. That is the special relationship. That is a special relationship in operation. And clearly it's for the President to take decisions that he considers in the national interest, the right decisions for the US. I understand that. I respect that. But equally, it's for me as the British Prime Minister to take decisions that I consider to be in the best interest of the United Kingdom. There's nothing controversial about that. The special relationship is operating right here at an important point. Thank you very much, Stephen. Pippa from The Guardian.
Yes, Prime Minister. Obviously, you said a lot of people are very concerned about this conflict escalating. Has Donald Trump given you any insight into what his plan is for what comes next after the initial bombing phase? And are you convinced he has a plan? And if I can just push on the defence spending point, because increasing in defence spending to 3% of GDP by 2030 would take up all real terms growth, unless, of course, you're raising money elsewhere to pay for it. Are you going to raise money to pay for it, or are you going to make cuts elsewhere?
Firstly, on the risk of escalation, clearly that is a concern for everybody. It will be a concern for everybody who is watching and across the country. And that's why we've been absolutely clear that we need to de-escalate. In relation to discussions with the Americans, obviously they're happening at all levels. I've had discussions with President Trump, but all of my team are having discussions all the time with the Americans about the operation. In relation to defence spending, we've set out our plans for the increase that we've already put in place. I've made commitments at the NATO summit last year and at the Munich conference, and I was clear then that we will need to go further and faster. Thank you very much, Pippa. And Sophie from The Mirror. Sophie.
So the current situation in the Middle East could potentially lead to the displacement of millions of people in the region. Are you expecting this to play out in more asylum claims, including small boat arrivals from the region? And are you concerned that cuts to the international aid budget could impact the UK's ability to handle situations exactly like this? And if I can also just ask, have you spoken to Donald Trump since his criticism of you?
In relation to the situation that's developed, obviously we don't yet know how long this will last. We don't know what the full impact will be, and therefore we'll have to address those considerations as we get to them. And we will, because we are planning both the immediate day-to-day response, but also looking at the further scenarios into the future. In relation to Donald Trump, I spoke to him on Saturday evening last weekend. Thank you all very much indeed. Thank you.
That was Sir Keir Starmer. He was in Downing Street, of course. I think that implies he hasn't spoken to Donald Trump since the weekend. So that's interesting in itself. This is Jane Garvey. I'm here on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. The WhatsApp number is 0333 003 2353. Lots from you already, and we'll go to those messages in a moment or two. So Sir Keir Starmer in that press conference was offering what he called calm, level-headed leadership in the national interest. And he was clear right at the start there that he stands by his decision not to join in the initial attacks. But we do now know that 4 additional Typhoon fighter jets are going to Qatar. The evacuation now well underway. The Prime Minister said it was bigger than the evacuation from Afghanistan. 7 more flights have left the UAE for the UK today. And he did acknowledge there in those questions that the war could go on for some time. Keep your thoughts coming. We'll just keep you up to date now with the very latest news on the conflict in the Middle East. Iran has attacked the UAE, Qatar and Israel. Azerbaijan says 2 people were wounded in an Iranian drone strike, despite Iranian denials. And a US tanker in the north of the Persian Gulf has also reportedly been hit. US and Israeli airstrikes on Iran are continuing. Times Radio Breakfast heard earlier from an Iranian woman we're calling Rosita, who is opposed to the regime.
We are all fine. No normal civilian is hurt. The attacks are very accurate. We don't have fear from the missile attacks or whatever. We just have the fear of the undercover people, and IRGC all fully armed in the streets, because every now and then you see a bunch of people with no formal dress or clothing who have guns, Kalashnikovs, whatever, and they can shoot you if they feel they want to. So that is our most biggest fear. And we are all happy that Khamenei is dead. This is a very, very great thing. And we have a very strange feeling of happiness, hope, and sadness, because he could be dead before and our lives would be spared. But what we are thankful to Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu and all the guys who are fighting for us.
Well, that was a woman that we are calling Rosita. You might well have heard her powerful contribution to Times Radio Breakfast this morning. Now, before 3 o'clock, I am going to be talking to Times Radio's political editor, Anna Mikhailova, and later in the programme to Richard Spencer, who is a Times correspondent. He's currently on the border between Turkey and Iran. And I know he's got some interesting information from there. Now, it is, I'm very sad to say, it's the final Wix Proud as a Peacock Thursday. And I know it's quite a contrast to the rest of the content today, serious times. But look, you could win 250 quid to spend at Wix. Just tell us what has made you feel proud in the last week or so. And I just want to bring in Lindsay, who has already been in touch via janeandfee@times.radio. That's the email address. She says, Jane and Fee, I'm proud as a peacock as my sister, brother-in-law and three-year-old niece are moving from Leicestershire to be near us in Norfolk. My sister and brother-in-law do an amazing job looking after my niece, who has complex health needs. With the expense of the move, that £250 voucher would be so welcome to help them get underway with projects on their new home. I'm so looking forward to having them closer and being able to help out with my gorgeous little niece. That's from Lindsay. Well, lots of love to your niece, Lindsay, and indeed to the rest of your family. You're definitely in the mix. You could well win that voucher. Send us a WhatsApp as well if you can't get to the email. The WhatsApp number, 0333 003 2353. We'll announce the winner at the very end of the programme today. And don't forget, the Wix kitchen and bathroom sale is on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store. Now, next, a battle between Gen Z and the old guard. We're going to get analysis of today's big election in Nepal. Here are the news headlines on Times Radio. James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister says he's focused on providing calm-headed leadership in the national interest as he defended the government's response to the crisis in the Middle East. Speaking at Downing Street, Sakir Starmer said he stands by his decision not to join the initial US-Israeli strikes on Iran. He also claimed Britain had been building up its defensive capability in January and February ahead of the conflict. Wildcat helicopters with anti-drone capabilities are arriving in Cyprus tomorrow, while four more Typhoon jets will join an RAF squadron in Qatar. The government is facing growing pressure after a drone hit a British base in Cyprus, while the UK still has no naval ships in the region. But the Prime Minister insisted Britain was prepared.
Long before the US and Israeli action last weekend, we had already deployed additional military capabilities to the region to defend our interests. Throughout January and February, we were moving defensive assets to Cyprus and Qatar. Fighter jets, air defence missiles, advanced radar and systems to take down drones. To ensure we were in a heightened state of readiness in advance of any conflict beginning.
The Prime Minister also said the UK-US special relationship is in operation after he was criticised by President Trump for his response to the conflict. The Prime Minister revealed the UK government's first charter flight for citizens stuck in the Middle East has now departed from Oman. Elsewhere, the Home Secretary's confirmed sweeping changes to the UK's immigration system. Accommodation and financial support will be removed from asylum seekers who break the law or work illegally. Some families could be offered up to £40,000 to leave the country voluntarily. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
With up to £3,000 every year towards career growth at Amazon, I started in the warehouse knowing I could train in things like coding or robotics. It turns my job into a career. So it means I can be who I want to be, even if I haven't quite decided who that is yet.
Amazon, opening doors with up to £3,000 every year towards career growth. Eligibility conditions about type and duration of employment apply.
Elite athletes know performance isn't just about pushing harder, it's about smart recovery. That mindset sparked MyoMaster, founded by Lottie White and Harlequins rugby player Joe Gray, now a thriving recovery brand. As MyoMaster grew, Lottie knew their finances needed to perform at the same level as their products. That's why they chose Xero accounting software. MyoMaster uses Xero for making tax digital for VAT. They've seen how taking your finances digital strengthens a business. And from April 6th, making tax digital for income tax means many sole traders and landlords must keep digital records and submit quarterly updates. MyoMaster's advice? Don't see MTD as just compliance. See it as a performance upgrade. Xero brings MyoMaster's sales, payroll and VAT into one place, giving Lottie confidence in her compliance and the insight to plan her next moves. With Xero, you can change the way you see MTD. Search MTD Ready.
Daryl Morris brings you a first look at the Sunday Times front page splash every Saturday night from 10:30.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, I said lots of you somewhat exercised today would be one way of putting it. Frank says it would indeed be somewhat humorous if the war lasted longer than 90 days and our tax exiles coming home end up paying tax here. From Martin, just listen to Starmer. Does he have a clue what's going on? That ship's still in the UK. That's HMS Dragon. He's wound up Trump and all the grovelling he did in the past counted for nothing. He sent the defence secretary to Cyprus. What's the point? They think he's a joke. Note to Starmer, stop the university politics and own the issue. I'm just looking, John Pienaar's in the studio with me now, and I can't see on our message board so far any support for Keir Starmer.
No, and on the show today, Jen, I'm going to be just trying to look objectively on the evidence with some expert thinking and opinion on it. The answer to that question, I mean, does Keir Starmer know what he's doing? Are we getting real leadership from Keir Starmer? Even without malice or starting from a position of prejudice, does it really amount to leadership? Yesterday, we had the Prime Minister, and today, saying he's standing up for British interests. Whatever Donald Trump may say, he's free to disagree, which sounds like a form of leadership. Not everyone will agree with it, but it sounds like a form of leadership. But has he been pushed into even that? You know, interesting report. In the Spectator, that some of the cabinet ministers on the left and right of the cabinet basically said, no, you can't go there with firmer support for the United States. And he didn't actually deny that at his news conference a moment ago.
The suggestion was Ed Miliband had talked to him.
Ed Miliband, but also Shabana Mahmood and also Yvette Cooper. And that, as I say, he sought to knock it down, but he didn't absolutely deny it. It does leave the question, what sort of leadership are we getting? But then there's a subsidiary question, another big one. Can anyone really know what they're doing when Donald Trump may not know what he's doing? When he's running
the war.
Well,
he didn't answer that question either.
No, he didn't. No, he didn't. That would maybe be impolitic and undiplomatic. But for us, it's a very real question. Mm. So I'm going to be talking to the Foreign Office Minister, Hamish Falcon. I'm going to be talking to Simon Fraser, former head of the Diplomatic Service. I'm going to be talking to James Jeffrey, who's a former National Security Deputy Advisor under George Bush. And after six, we're going to give a full hour to looking at the thing in more depth. I'm going to be talking to John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor to Trump, and to the former head of MI6, John Sawyers. So it's going to be a busy, big programme.
Right. So people can get their questions in, can they?
And if people want to put their questions in, they are very, very much invited to do that. 8722, the normal way. Start with the word Times and say what you would like to know.
Yeah. Well, the email is studio@times.radio. It's a really good way to get in touch. And I think that'll be a fascinating listen, actually, with John and his esteemed guests between 6 and 7 tonight here on Times Radio. That is quite the lineup. Former US Ambassador to the UN, John Bolton, former MI6 Chief, Sir John Sawyers, and Catherine Philp, the Times World Affairs Editor. Your questions, please, to studio@times.radio. Now, we could talk about the elections in Nepal. We hope to be doing that very soon. We could also... We're going to do it now. It's one of those days where we're never entirely certain what's happening next, and I know that you'll understand why that is. Half a year on from the toppling of Nepal's prime minister by tech-enabled youth protesters, the Himalayan country is going to the polls today. The contest is pitting new and angry challengers against the old guard of the establishment parties. Let's have a word with Nimesh Dungana, who's a lecturer at the University of Manchester, is himself a citizen of Nepal. Nimesh, thank you very much for talking to me this afternoon. Tell us what's at stake here, and indeed remind us what happened in Nepal last year.
Thanks for having me. So indeed, this is really an important moment for Nepal. It's a very consequential and significant election that actually just ended, because Nepal is 5 years ahead of us. So as of now, the polling has concluded and the initial reports indicate that the elections were peaceful and there were no significant conflict or disputes. I believe this marks a major victory for the country in terms of democratic transition and peaceful transfer of power, particularly because, as you already mentioned, so this election is an unusual election because it's happened in the backdrop of last September's youth protest, popularly known as Gen Z protest, that was met with state repression and violence. Resulted in the death of over 70 people and led to the falling of the then elected government led by the Communist Party of Nepal, UML's KP Sharma Oli. So the pre-election activities from the, you know, kind of emergence of new leaders and new parties to election campaigns were heavily influenced by the collective trauma of the September violence that people are still reeling from. So having said that, I think the country, it seems that the election went, as I said, quite peacefully. And I also, I think the current government, and particularly the one, the former Chief Justice Sushila Karki, who had this caretaker government, the first woman prime minister, actually, of Nepal, she deserves major congratulations. Yeah.
Okay, well, noted. I confess I didn't know about her, so that's one lesson learned. What are the major issues? I mean, I guess very similar to much of the rest of the world. Unemployment, the economy's in trouble, isn't it? There's a lack of equality, a perceived lack of equality anyway.
Absolutely, and I think that was one of the main reasons. Like the last protest that happened was really about, it was a protest against rampant corruption, systemic abuse of power, but also nepotism, right? So people were really unhappy about the system of patronage that has developed over time. Another main issue at this election at stake is also the growing out-country migration from the country. So large number of people actually go to Middle East, Southeast Asian countries for employment. And so young people are actually, young population is dwindling in the country. So this has also been really an election that is really trying to bring back those opportunities. And that is one of the main agenda of the September protests. So there's a lot at stake. I think there's lots of new parties, new faces that have come in the picture, which I think is also a hopeful time for Nepal. I'm really hopeful that the parliament will really deliberate on some of these substantive issues that you also mentioned.
Yes, and neighbours of Nepal will be taking a keen interest, won't they? What do China and India want to happen?
Well, it's obviously they have a country that is sandwiched between these emerging powers. It always have some kind of influence from these two neighbors. India more so, because we are more culturally, socially connected to each. To India, and also we share about 1,500 kilometer open border with India. So India already has a major influence on Nepal and Nepali politics. China, increasingly so in the recent years. It was not so involved in the past, but it's been more actively involved in Nepal's domestic affairs. So far, I think even the pre-election kind of circumstances, condition, if you see, they've all welcomed this new election. The mandate of this caretaker government was to hold this election. That was the exclusively the task of this government. And the India and in both India and China has kind of welcomed this election. I haven't seen anything coming from India and China yet. But I think they will probably be welcoming the result of the election, whichever direction it goes.
Right. And just in practical terms, it's an incredible country, Nepal, but the terrain, presumably it doesn't lend itself to elections, really, to the running of elections and the counting of votes. How hard is all that?
Oh, it's extremely hard. So I think so. One of the things that the Election Commission, which is oversees and manages the election, it says that it will start the counting process as soon as it kind of collects the ballot boxes from different parts of the country. And that's one of the reasons, because there are some places that are not so accessible. So you need to bring in those ballot boxes from those places in helicopters and other areas that are not. So I think it is definitely a huge task to run the election in this country. There was also a lot of concern about security, you know, like particularly because it's happening in the backdrop of the September protests. But I think so far it's been quite well. There's also been some reports about in some places, some remote areas where people have completely rejected the election. Polling stations, nobody showed up, which is, I think, a really interesting thing. There's one news from one of the remote areas of Nepal. So it is also not only shows the operational difficulties of running the election, but also the voters' mood and what is at stake here.
Thank you very much indeed for your time. That's Nimesh Dongana, who's a lecturer at the University of Manchester, telling us there about the elections in Nepal. You're with Times Radio, and our political editor, Anna Mihailova, was at Downing Street for Keir Starmer's press conference, started around 2 o'clock. You will have heard it here on Times Radio if you were listening at that point. Anna, I have to say, looking at the message board here, listeners underwhelmed. What did you learn?
Well, one of the main takeaways is the Prime Minister telling the nation that this conflict could continue for some time. He wouldn't specify how long, but I think that is a bit of expectation management. He is laying the groundwork for this to continue, and it shows the heightened level of uncertainty the government is having to deal with. He was also very keen to try and get on the front foot and deny reports that he was unprepared. He began in his speech by the UK was at a heightened state of readiness. So, and then a lot of the questions were about concerns that the UK wasn't ready, that a crucial warship is still in port, and that allies are worried that the UK, that he was dragging his feet and he was too slow to respond. So he's very, very keen to try and deny that and say that what he's doing is offering calm, level-headed leadership. But the question is, are people going to be convinced by that?
Well, I have to say, let me just look at some of the messages that we've had coming in, just to give you a flavour, Anna. Matt says, cometh the hour, cometh the mouse. Alistair says, on the other hand, I want to support Starmer and I want people to know I support him. The difficulty for all of us is we just don't know what is really true, especially with Trump and company shooting off random comments. I mean, I have to say, I can see where Alistair's coming from. And indeed, the Prime Minister was asked if he knew what Donald Trump's plan for Iran was. And based on his answer, Anna, I don't think he does know.
But I think, to be fair, I think a lot of the people around Donald Trump also do not know. And you could even make the argument that Donald Trump's view on it can change depending on the day. So I think that is an amount of uncertainty the government is having to grapple with. The Prime Minister said that he made a point of referencing pressure. So he said that he would make decisions no matter the pressure. So that is quite a clear message about what he clearly sees as pressure from Donald Trump and all the comments that Donald Trump has made criticizing him personally. So he's trying to say that he's standing firm and he's trying to de-escalate the conflict. But the problem is, as you say, he doesn't know where it's going to land. He doesn't know where it's going to end up. And setting aside this issue with the US and whether or not the special relationship is working properly, he insists it is. But setting even that aside, you've got criticism from British allies in the Gulf who are expecting to be protected, and they do not feel that they have been. They do not feel that the UK has supported them in the way that it could and should have done.
Yes, I think people are particularly exercised by HMS Dragon and the fact that it won't be leaving until next week. I mean, that does run the risk of making us look pretty stupid, actually, doesn't it?
And the Prime Minister was asked about that, and in answer, he just didn't address it. He talked repeatedly about other measures he's taking. So particularly, he says that, you know, planes, British planes were in the air, even on Saturday, as soon as the attacks started. He said that he will be sending 4 more typhoons. He'll be sending more wildcat helicopters. So he's keen to emphasise that, but he didn't really have an answer about HMS Dragon. And as you say, the symbolism of that not being ready, still being in port, still, there is no suggestion it'll be able to leave any time before next week. That just does not make the government look like it was, as he says, in a heightened state of readiness.
Right. And as to the length of the conflict, well, he just said it could go on for some time. But there was an acknowledgement that, frankly, Anna, people are worried. This is something that has got, I think, the entire planet very, very concerned. And people in Britain are worried about their children's prospects, worried about relatives in the Middle East. The whole thing is a really extraordinarily difficult time for everybody, isn't it?
Of course. And he gave an update about the planes that are the charter flights that are leaving the Middle East. The first flight took off from Oman, bringing British citizens back home. He says more will be to follow. And to give an indication about the scale of what we're preparing for, he says this will be the operation to bring people home will be bigger than the operation to get people out of Afghanistan. And you remember how much criticism there was then of that government's handling of it. I think it was interesting to hear him say that he recognises people are worried. But the truth is, when asked about a time frame or more specifics, he just doesn't have those answers, partly because there are just so many things in the air. And you do get a sense that he is not in the room necessarily in the way that he perhaps could have been with Donald Trump, who is obviously driving a lot of the decision-making. He says that he last spoke to the president on Saturday. Of course, there'll be a lot of engagement behind the scenes on the official level and particularly on the defence and security level. But it is telling you something that the president and the prime minister are not speaking on a regular or even daily basis.
Yeah, so it's nearly a week since they spoke and we know that. OK, thank you very much, Anna. Times Radio's political editor, Anna Mikhailova. She was at Downing Street. It is 10 to 3. It's Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's the pinnacle event of the jump racing calendar, the Cheltenham Festival. And from the excitement of Champion Day all the way to the unforgettable drama of Gold Cup Day, Times Radio will keep you up to date with all the action and results as they happen. Cheltenham Festival updates throughout the festival on Times Radio with Ladbrokes. We bring daily free bets for Cheltenham. That's Laddisfaction. 18+, gambleaware.org.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday. Right now, we've got some great deals available. Plus, you'll get the best choice of our free Child Place holidays. Book now with just a £60 deposit per person. Enjoy flexible monthly payments and go direct from London Gatwick. Jet 2 Holidays. Package holidays you can trust. Aptronatural protected. Subject to availability and conditions.
1983 election, she's won a landslide second term.
Police have been deployed to disperse crowds as the poll tax riots escalate.
Credit crunches continuing to spread from the USA.
Britain has left the European Union.
I mean, this goes on. Boris, Liz,
we've
Richie.
Helped Britain invest through 45 years of change. That's why we're the UK's number one investment and savings platform, trusted by 2 million people. Hargreaves Lansdown, helping Britain invest for it all. Investment returns vary. For claim verification, visit hl.co.uk.
When you leave a gift in your will to guide dogs, where could it lead? It might lead to our specialists helping someone regain their independence, like Jenny.
I'd just gone from everything to nothing. She gave me my freedom back. She gave me my confidence back.
Your gift to guide dogs could lead to a future where lives are transformed. Find out how to make your life-changing will for free. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
guide dogs.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Transform your kitchen or bathroom. Wix has everything you need, plus all the finishing touches, from beautiful tiles and flooring to a wide choice in paint and lighting. Whatever you're planning, create the perfect space with Wix.
Now, if you are a reader of The Times, you'll be well acquainted with the brilliant features writer Helen Rombolow, who produced a fantastic, if unsettling, piece last week about the link between the worlds of Epstein, Pellico and pornography. Millions watch porn, few people talk about it, but its impact is undeniable. I asked Helen why she always seems to be the person saddled with writing about the subject.
Well, actually, it goes back to 1999, which is really long time ago now, and a kind of centuries in terms of porn. But I happened to be a young female reporter on this paper covering a case, which was, again, this sounds so antiquated now, but it was about a video, a porn video, and it was the British government basically wanting to prevent hardcore being shown in Britain, which now, again, incredibly antiquated, this idea of videos, and also the idea of hardcore, meaning what it did then, which was literally just showing sex on screen. And I actually had this conversation, because I've been doing porn more recently now for the paper, but I had this conversation with a young man in the office. He was like, what? It was illegal to see sex on screen? And I was like, yep. But yeah, so I've kind of covered the full arc of it, because back then there was this very kind of liberalizing sex positive idea, especially amongst young women, of which I was one, that, you know, we should just, you know, stop being so uptight and let everything be free and, you know, nothing to be ashamed of. And I feel like everything I've seen now, I've come sort of full circle against it.
I'm really glad I asked that. So that's a quarter of a century ago.
Yes.
And I don't remember that. I must admit, I don't remember that case. I mean, well, no. What happened with that video in the end? Was
it
banned?
I mean, it was Biddy Baxter, the
editor of Blue Peter.
Yes. She was on the side of the porn agents. And, you know, that was very emblematic of the age, and it did actually get legalised, and it was kind of in its own little way a landmark case, but that quickly became completely irrelevant, because then the internet came along and everything changed. And, you know, the idea of hardcore, meaning what it did then, that now it means something that, you know, you don't even want to imagine, but it's,
okay. Yeah. Well, we can. In fact, we're going to talk about it.
Yes.
Can I just quote something that you wrote last week, and I just thought it was so powerful. If a bunch of female tech barons were making millions out of algorithms and image and tutorial sharing groups, and that was showing up degrading sex and worse for men, would we have more questions? And that's something I quite often ask myself. If this was flipped around, if, for example, Epstein had been female and the female Epstein was recruiting loads of influential women, former prime ministers, heads of the IMF, and they were all getting together and having sex with young lads, that's a different world and it's not the world we live in. But we would ask more questions, surely.
Yes, and I think this kind of gets into where porn meets feminism, which is a really difficult question, I think, because one thing I was shocked about when I went on to Pornhub, which is now a couple of years ago, and it was simply the way in which women's role in porn had completely changed. So I think I mentioned there that initial case, the porn video in question was called Making Whoopee, and it was simply a woman having a great time having sex.
When she was having pleasurable sex.
Pleasurable sex, yeah. And, you know, let them have their fun sort of thing. When I went back on, really what I saw was just misogyny on an industrial scale. I mean, I was actually really, truly shocked that day at how much punishment women were being put through. And, you know, it led to some really deep, dark questions about men that I didn't want to face.
We should make clear, what you watched on Pornhub was all legal.
All legal.
So easy to access.
There's not a single barrier to access. You just clicked on. Now, just very recently, actually, that has changed in the UK. And actually, for that reason, Pornhub has effectively blocked its site because it didn't want to cooperate with the age verification
And we've got to ask ourselves, and I know you've already said it's a difficult thing to discuss, but why is it so many men get off on the idea of causing harm to women and hurting them? These are questions that are at the very root of all this, and I don't want to really talk about it either, but we do have to.
Yeah, we do have to. And in a funny sort of way, I am the wrong person to ask because I don't know. I mean, I did talk about it a little bit recently because I met with Manon Garcia, who she's a French, young French philosophy professor, and she went to the whole of the Gisèle Pelicot trial and wrote a book about it. And I was really interested in what she thought because in so many of the videos, they talk about punishment and you think, what are women being punished for? You know, it's the same with this word for revenge porn. You think, this word revenge, you know, what have the women done? They've done nothing. They've had a sort of photograph taken of them by their husbands, you know, possibly without their knowledge. It's really intriguing. And she said women are being punished by men because they're making men feel less powerful. And I think that's one idea. But I would really like to. I would really like to hear men talk about it. I think there is something about porn that's very different from real life sex. In real life sex, both parties should have a good time. In porn, it's about power. It just is, just in terms of the mechanics of it, because there's only one person there whose satisfaction is important, and the other people, the performers, they're doing a job. And so they are deliberately, like, dehumanising themselves in order to arouse. And the person watching the porn is aroused by their sort of dehumanisation. So there's the power thing is kind of baked into porn. And I think that gaze, that kind of, you know, that very dehumanising gaze when you're looking at porn, it's not the same as a criminal gaze, but I think it's, you know, parallel to it.
Right.
You know, to be a criminal, you have to kind of dehumanize your victim. To watch porn, you have to kind of see them as a little bit less human than yourself. You know, you just can't be thinking about them picking up the kids from school afterwards in the same way as you can't think about them being trafficked or underage.
That's Helen Rumbelow, and a much longer version of that conversation will be a Friday bonus episode of Off Air with Jane and Fee. You can listen to that tomorrow. And Helen's piece, Epstein, Pelicot and the Toxic Culture of Teen Porn, is on thetimes.com.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and this is Jane Garvey on Times Radio. In the next hour, US and Israeli strikes on Iran continue, with many Iranians trying to flee them. We'll talk to the Times' Richard Spencer, who's on the Turkey-Iran border right now. The regime continues to attack targets, including Qatar. We'll hear from an Iranian foreign relations expert based there. And we'll talk sport with Vassos Alexander. Arsenal are winning, but they are winning dull. And we'll talk to the BAFTA-winning director, Georgie Wildman, about her film about endometriosis. That'll be after 3:30. Here's the news at 3, James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister says he's focused on providing calm, level-headed leadership in the national interest as he defended the government's response to the crisis in the Middle East. Speaking at Downing Street, Keir Starmer said he stands by his decision not to join the initial US-Israeli strikes on Iran. He also claimed Britain had been building up its defensive capability in January and February ahead of the conflict. Wildcat helicopters with anti-drone capabilities are arriving in Cyprus tomorrow, while 4 more Typhoon jets will join a RAF squadron in Qatar. The government is facing growing pressure after a drone hit a British base in Cyprus, while the UK still has no naval ships in the region. But the Prime Minister insisted Britain was prepared.
Long before the US and Israeli action last weekend, we had already deployed additional military capabilities to the region to defend our interests. Throughout January and February, we were moving defensive assets to Cyprus and Qatar. Fighter jets, air defence missiles, advanced radar and systems to take down drones, to ensure we were in a heightened state of readiness in advance of any conflict beginning.
Responding to a question from The Times, the Prime Minister insisted the UK-US special relationship is in operation after he was criticised by President Trump for his response to the conflict. Sir Keir Starmer also revealed the government's first charter flight for British nationals stranded in the Middle East has now departed from Oman. Explosions have been heard across Tehran on the sixth day of US-Israeli strikes, while Israel says it continues to eliminate Iranian retaliatory attacks. The UAE reports intercepting six Iranian missiles and 131 drones, but one missile and six drones fell inside the country. The British Embassy in Abu Dhabi earlier warned people to shelter in place. Across the region, explosions were reported in Qatar and Bahrain. Azerbaijan says it was attacked by two Iranian drones. Meanwhile, Tehran claims to have hit an American-flagged tanker in the northern Gulf. Elsewhere, the Home Secretary is proposing changes to the immigration system, which will see some families offered up to £40,000 to leave the UK. Accommodation and financial support will be removed from asylum seekers who are caught working illegally under a new conditional offer of support. Another proposal is to remove study visas from migrants from four countries where abuse is prevalent. 40 Labour MPs are threatening to rebel against the policies, but Gareth Snell, who represents Stoke-on-Trent Central, told Times Radio the reforms reflect the party's values.
It was about making sure that the system is fair, that it is robust, that it works for everybody, but that with the rights that you have if you come to the country are also a responsibility. What the Home Secretary set out today was a clear new way of doing immigration policy in this country that I believe represents the Labour values that we all hold.
The Times has revealed that Oxfam considered abandoning disaster relief to become an influencer. A draft plan from August seen by the paper shows a push for the charity to step back from emergency relief. It would instead focus on campaigning on issues including climate, gender and inequality. The proposal was rejected following a meeting of the charity's chiefs in Istanbul late last year. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's almost 3:05. Good afternoon. It's just worth saying that some of Sir Keir Starmer's supporters have now made contact, so it's only fair that I read some of their messages out as well. Tracy says, I'm just wondering what the critics of Starmer would like him to be doing that he isn't. Specifics. It's easy to criticise, but what would be better than what the government is doing so far, please, in specific terms? Right. Tracy has, what is the expression, put down the gauntlet. She's wants to know what it is you want him to be doing and saying. And Chris says Keir Starmer is unfairly criticised for his stance on Iran. I can't think of any potential leader currently who is better placed to be in charge of us. The UK is in the position of having to respond, not lead. And we must remember that under the Tories, there were 14 years of reduced military budgets. We welcome all opinion here on 0333 003 2353. So Sir Keir Starmer did hold a press conference about an hour ago at Downing Street. And during that, he says the UK is in a heightened state of readiness and was prepared for the conflict in the Middle East.
Throughout January and February, we were moving defensive assets to Cyprus and Qatar. Fighter jets, air defence missiles, advanced radar and systems to take down drones. To ensure we were in a heightened state of readiness in advance of any conflict beginning. When the strikes began on Saturday, we immediately put those jets into the sky.
Israel and Iran continue to exchange missile and air attacks today. Warning sirens have sounded over Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, while explosions have caused widespread damage in Tehran. The Israeli Defense Forces are also attacking the Iranian-allied Hezbollah militia in Lebanon. The UAE says it's intercepted dozens of missiles and drones, while explosions have been reported in Qatar, Bahrain and Azerbaijan today. Now, thousands of people are on the move in Iran, people desperate to get away from the bombing, of course. And the Times correspondent Richard Spencer is on the Turkey-Iran border, where people have been queuing to get out of Iran, but also, it has to be said, to get back in as well. Richard Spencer, tell us about the scenes you've seen at the border.
So the border, it's in a very dramatic location, right up in the mountains on the border between Turkey and Iran, snow-covered mountains, and otherwise really quite beautiful, apart from, you know, what's going on behind those mountains where we know there is intense bombing. And indeed, some of the people coming out of Iran yesterday described having narrowly evaded bombing on the roads as they came north from Tehran to the border. One woman gave a very dramatic account of a factory being hit just as she was passing by a missile from Israeli or American missile, and she was shaking as she crossed the border. And this was must have been about 12 hours later, I guess, from when that incident happened. They are obviously, people are trying to leave. People are trying to get away from the bombing. People, particularly obviously people with visas or dual nationals who have passports enabling them to get out. It's quite difficult. The Iranians are not making it easy for those who want to leave. Apparently, we were told missiles hit an immigration building or part of the interior ministry, I guess, knocking out all the immigration servers. So border guards were sort of ringing through passport details to check against a database of people who were banned from leaving. But there were people leaving, and they told us these stories. And obviously, people outside were trying to get back in to see their families. The internet and phone lines to the outside world are cut. So they were literally had not heard from their families since the start of the bombing and were terrified as to what might have happened to them.
Well, I hope lots of people will now go and find your piece on thetimes.com, Richard. Perhaps they've already read it. But I was really struck in that article, not just by the stories of the people trying to get out, but by those stories of people trying to get back in because they realise that their place is with their families now. Tell us about them.
I think you know, the point one makes is that these terrible events, anywhere in the world, obviously, but particularly in the Middle East, they really present very difficult choices to everyone. I mean, we often see in Britain the end result of those choices when people fleeing these war zones end up taking the boats across the Channel, which is, of course, a difficult choice in itself, given the dangers. But before that, there are all these difficult questions of, you know, do you stay with your families? Do you try and take your families away and then, you know, risk never going home again? I've met people regularly on borders across the Middle East in the last decade, 15 years, who left home for 2 weeks because there was fighting, thought they'd be back. And literally 10 years later, they still haven't been able to go back to their homes, their towns, their countries. So that's a great risk. And again, as I say, from the other people, these are mainly migrant workers, people who go abroad because the economy is so terrible in Iran. Working abroad, one man had left his wife and four children back home in the city of Urmia in Iran, and he was working on a building site in Turkey. And he said, I couldn't be away. I had to be with my wife. I had to be with my children. I couldn't sit in Turkey anymore, not knowing what was happening to them. Entirely understandable point of view, obviously. But he said, when I get there, I have no idea how I'm going to provide for them because I don't have a job. There are no jobs. And you know, if there were, how would you get a job at a time like this? So how do I feed my children once I've gone back to them? These are terrible choices people have to make.
Yes, and some of the older people in Iran will have already endured the Iran-Iraq war, which I always forget. It went on for nearly a decade, didn't it, that?
Yeah, the timescales, I mean, maybe it's because I'm getting older, but, you know, timescales sort of, you know, you lose track of these things. I mean, it seems such a distant past, the Iran-Iraq war, because since then we've had, you know, we've had two wars in which Britain was involved in Iraq in 1991 and 2003. We've had the whole chaos of the Arab Spring, another war in Iraq to fight ISIS. And yet it's not that long ago. I mean, you know, these people my age were already adults by the time the war finished. And they have very vivid memories of Iraqi missiles landing in Tehran and other cities. So they have been through it before. And so the older people tend to be a little bit more philosophical, shall we say, about what's happening. And it's the younger people really who you know, they both have grown up under this regime and can see no end to it. They can see no end to the, you know, whatever their political opinions, they can see no end to the suffering, the sanctions, the attrition, the regime crackdowns, shooting at protesters, and these bouts of bombing and fighting. Iran, of course, has sent its own men off to fight in wars in the Arab Spring with Hezbollah, with the Syrian regime, the Assad regime. So the younger people both don't have the experience of being bombed so heavily from the skies, nor do they have any real understanding of how it can all end. What other Iran can there be? So they tend to be really quite fragile, I'd say. I mean, I don't want to be patronizing.
None
of us know what we would be like under those circumstances.
Exactly.
But they say, what is our future? What is our future now? What is the future for our children, you know, and the children we have yet to bear?
Yeah. And the chance of regime change, I really understand that you're not in Tehran, which is where I suppose the action in that area would probably have to take place. But the idea that this would happen quickly, that perhaps this was something the Trump administration had hoped for, what would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's you get these incredibly contradictory messages out of the White House all the time, and we have had all week, about even whether he wants regime change. I mean, I think Trump said it would be nice if it happened, but on the other hand, it might be better if someone from within the regime took over. Or he said from within Iran, which effectively means, I guess, from within the regime. We don't know what he really wants. Israel clearly wants a weaker Iran, one that isn't able to threaten it, doesn't probably care quite so much about the political complexion of the regime after this is over. I don't think anyone ever goes on the streets when when there are F-35s flying overhead. You'll be pretty crazy to do so. And judging by my colleague Gabriel Vaniger's report, who was talking to people in Tehran via satellite link over the last few days, there is very tough security in the streets. The besieged, which is the Revolutionary Guard police force, have set up checkpoints everywhere. There's really not much incentive to try and topple the regime from the streets. The opposition is unarmed largely in Iran, apart from a couple of the separatist movements, but they're right at the fringes of Iran in the far northwest, right, near where I am, or in the far east of the country. I think if there's going to be regime change, it's going to be more like a internal coup within the, you know, say the Revolutionary Guard or the clerical establishment, to appoint a new type of leader who will do a deal with the Americans. But again, there is no sign of that at the moment.
And just a brief word about the possibility of arming some Kurdish rebel groups. Could that happen?
It obviously could. The CIA clearly have the ability to do that. They've done that in the past with opposition movements in the Middle East. They've done it with Kurdish movements, obviously. I mean, the Kurds have historically been allies to the West in many different ways in the Middle East. The Peshmerga, the Kurdish forces in Iraqi Kurdistan, they have a semi-autonomous republic, partly thanks to Western backing. And, of course, the offshoot of the PKK that is the main armed group in the Kurdish parts of northern Syria were all our allies in the fight against ISIS. It often hasn't turned out particularly well for them. They are kind of expendable, as it's proved with the Kurds in Syria, where the White House has sided basically with the new regime in Damascus rather than with the Kurds, trying to organise some sort of compromise between them. I think with Iran, it's very difficult. I mean, the Kurdish, the armed Kurdish groups are much smaller as a portion of the Kurdish population in Iran. Without getting too sort of ethno-nationalist about it, the Kurds are much more closely related in terms of, say, language group to and history to the Persians in Iran than they are, say, to the Turks or the Arabs. It's much more greater history of hostility between Kurds and Turks and Kurds and Arabs than between Kurds and Persians. It wouldn't be very popular, I think, amongst most Iranians, even the ones who are hostile to the regime, to have a separatist armed Kurdish insurrection in the northwest, and what that would mean for the rest of Turkey is very unclear. Kurds are about 10, maximum 15% of the Iranian population, and they are mostly in the far north.
Richard, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. That's the Times correspondent Richard Spencer. He is on the border between Turkey and Iran. I hope you found that helpful. I know I did. Let's bring in Mehran Kamarava, who's a professor of government specialising in Iran. He is based at Georgetown University in Qatar. Professor, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Can you tell us really what life in Qatar has been like for the last couple of days, and what has the public reaction been to everything going on?
Life in Qatar has come to a standstill for the last 4 or 5 days. We've been under a shelter-in-place order, except for necessities, most people are staying indoors. This is one of the safest cities in the world. Qatar is one of the safest countries. I live in Doha. And that safety and tranquility has been shattered. That sense of comfort has been shattered by loud explosions overhead. Most nights, there have been explosions. Last night, we actually managed to sleep through the night. But earlier today, about 2 hours ago, there were a series of explosions. It's now about 6 p.m. local time. So something around 4:30, I was actually, and a little earlier, I was in a Zoom meeting. Everything now has, again, like the days of COVID, has moved to Zoom here in this part of the world. I was in a Zoom meeting and everyone was frazzled. So this is not something that the local population is used to, this level of tension and uncertainty.
Do you know who or what is giving the orders in Tehran right now?
Well, we do know that before he was killed, Khamenei had said he wants four levels of successors to the different key institutions of the Islamic Republic. And so I spoke to someone earlier in Tehran today. Seemed like the Revolutionary Guard is firmly in control of the military, and the various institutions of the state are operating as per normal. And so, one thing to keep in mind about Islamic Republic is that it has been very good at crisis management over the last 40 some odd years. It has really been lousy at management. But in times of crisis, it has been able to muddle or manage through various crises, some of them, like this one, existential ones in the past.
So I think there were reports earlier in the week about a real discord between the Iranian army and the Revolutionary Guard and the potential for real trouble there. But you don't know anything about that, or that was simply a rumour that turned out to be just a rumour?
I don't know anything about it. I've never heard of it, in fact, and I follow events there very closely, and I'm in touch with people there as often as possible. So I would tend to believe, at least for my own analysis, that that's a rumour rather than fact.
So how, we've just been listening to our own Prime Minister Keir Starmer giving a press conference in which he acknowledged that he simply didn't know how long this was going to go on for, but it could be quite some time. What's your assessment?
Well, the Iranian government has long prepared itself for a prolonged conflict. And the assumption among Iranian leaders is that Iran has a much higher threshold for pain than either Israel or the United States or America's regional allies and friends. And so what we have are two very different assumptions about this war. The Americans and the Israelis want a quick and decisive victory, and the Iranians want, if not necessarily a war of attrition, but a prolonged conflict through which they can grind down American resolve. So how long this is going to last depends on a number of different factors. If the Iranians can have their way, it's going to go on for a while. If the Americans can have their way, it'll be a quick and decisive victory. I think it's also important to remember that Donald Trump has been very deliberately unpredictable. And so if he wanted to, tomorrow he could declare victory and say, we won and the hostilities are over.
Yeah.
Or he could drag this on, as he said, 4 to 5 weeks.
Thank you. Very sobering. That's Professor of Government, Professor Mehran Kamarava. He is based at Georgetown University in Qatar. It's Times Radio. It's 23 minutes past three. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we've been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
When you leave a gift in your will to guide dogs, where could it lead? It might lead to someone getting their first guide dog, like David.
I withdrew from everything. I could no longer do the things that really brought me joy. He put that smile back on my face.
Your gift to guide dogs could lead to a future where lives are transformed. Find out how to make your life-changing will for free. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide Dogs. The Story. The award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
I did ask what you'd... I was asking on behalf of a listener who wanted to know what people who don't like Keir Starmer wanted Keir Starmer to be doing. Gary says, what more can Starmer be doing? Well, he should have completed the defence review on time rather than kicking the can down the road so we can prioritise investment in defence. They need to go faster on increasing GDP spend on defence up to 5%. How can it make sense that we're spending more on benefits than on defence? And actually Mike's making the same point. One thing Starmer should do, put up income tax, spend some proper money on our armed forces. And Matt says the PM may have the skin of a rhino and the kind of mind that suits an academic conference, but in no sense nor at any point has he captured anyone's imagination. Right. Keep them coming. Although Keir Starmer probably doesn't want you to. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp. Are you as proud as a peacock? We've had some lovely messages today, and it's actually been really quite a joy doing these Proud as a Peacock Awards every Thursday because they do cheer us up, these stories. Sarah says, I'm as proud as a peacock of two of my eldest daughters who bought a complete wreck of a house 5 years ago and have lived together along with their partners throughout extensive lockdown renovations. Starting out with a 1-year-old, they've welcomed three more children to this house. Life is noisy, lively and chaotic, and I take my hat off to them for their tolerance, patience and understanding, enabling them to live together in harmony. They're now selling the property to go their separate ways and on to Rex anew. They would love the voucher. OK, Rex anew, that sounds very good. And briefly, Jackie in Sussex says, I'd like to nominate my 92-year-old mum for your Peacock Thursday Awards. Her granddaughter, that's my daughter, bought her house 3 years ago, but works full time and has been working on it every evening and at weekends. As my mum is 92, she says she will never see the house finished. The Peacock Award would allow my mum to buy her granddaughter a much needed multi-tool to help get some of those outstanding jobs done. Right, OK, that's a good one, isn't it, Vassos?
Well, the thing is, yeah, I mean, when they're very on message, you know, I quite like that.
Yes, I like that too.
I like the Rex anew, though. Yeah, it's just it's got a lovely ring about it, doesn't it?
We've got a very, very high quality of listener. We really have. It's still time. You have still time. You still have time. I'll get it right. 0333 003 2353 to take part, or email janeandfee@times.radio. We'll announce the winner at the end of the show. The Wix kitchen and bathroom sale is on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store. Vassos is here to talk about Arsenal, who won again last night.
Oh my goodness me, they're not making many friends, are they? They won 1-0 against Brighton. The manager, Fabian Hertzler of Brighton, only one team, he said, try to play football. I would never try and win a game like that. So Arsenal go 1-0 up early and then basically spend 85 minutes wasting time. Three times David Raya, the goalkeeper, went down and needed treatment on the pitch.
Oh, come on.
I know, come on, right? And Mikel Arteta, the Arsenal manager, says, oh, I love my players. I love the fight that they... And of course, you know, there is an element of time wasting when you're 1-0 up and you're hanging on for the 3 points. And Arsenal are going about this long wait for their league title. I mean, it's been a one-horse race this season and they're in danger of finishing second in a one-horse race. And all everybody who isn't an Arsenal fan is sort of hoping that Arsenal don't do it because of stuff like this. Because they play pretty dull football, they score most of their goals from set pieces. So they've scored 21 set-piece goals so far this season, in second in Manchester United on 15. So they, you know, great crosses in from corners, Declan Rice, and they've got their set piece coach and they know what they're doing and they know what they're doing inside the laws and they know where to push the laws a little bit elastically, but they're not making many friends. And it's the most sort of, I think the word might be constipated.
Constipated?
It's a sort of constipated title. They are so racked by fear and desperate not to look to come second for the fourth season running, that their football and their tactics leave a lot to be desired.
Yes, I enjoyed Alison Rudd's match report actually on the game last night. She says that Declan Rice had looked worn out when he left the pitch against Chelsea on Sunday. And actually, I think a few people didn't think he'd play last night, but he did. Mind you, he got the chance for some rest every time he loitered over a free kick, even if the chosen option was then just to pass it sideways. I mean, there is a lot of that, isn't there? There really is. I mean, I'm not an Arsenal fan, so I suppose I would say this.
They're not making many friends this season. And, you know, I think other fans would find it here. Also, the thing is, we sort of know that Arsenal fans will become, and this is definitely the word, insufferable if they do win the league this season. I mean, they have played some lovely football in the past, but it's just not this season. They've decided that it's win at all costs, and you don't blame them. They won't care. They haven't won the league since the Invincibles 22 years ago, nearly.
Long?
Yeah, 22 years since Arsenal last
won
the league.
Remind me of some of the players who were in that side. I mean, you're talking, it's Tony Adams and that lot, isn't
it? Yeah, Martin Keown, Ray Parler, who are presenters now on TalkSport. And Martin Keown was very funny last week. Do you remember when Arsenal lost to... Oh, no, drew with Wolves. They threw away a two-goal lead and everyone was saying, it's happening again, Arsenal. It's happening again. And to be fair, Man City blinked first last night in this title race. They drew against Nottingham Forest, so they dropped points and Arsenal didn't. And he got very cross with Andy Goldstein, who was laughing at Darren Bent, the Arsenal fan, on Drive. I was listening to that as I was driving to Gatwick Airport. It was very hilarious. And that's what football fans do. You give it and you take it. But Arsenal don't like it. Martin Keown didn't like it. He had a right old rant again. You just don't laugh at people. Don't laugh at people. Well, that's sort of what football... You've got to... If you can't laugh at football, come on.
Okay, yeah, it's entertainment, for heaven's sake. I know some people take it very seriously, but please...
Oh, listen, I take it very seriously. Right. I mean, I wasn't laughing uproariously as I was leaving Craven Cottage last night after Fulham had lost 1-0 at home to West Ham. Mm. But, you know, it's football.
It's the Hammers. They're in danger of relegation, aren't they? Or close, perilously close to it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay, so they probably needed that win.
They very much needed that win.
I think I could hear that. Unless QPR were at home last night, I could definitely hear football crowd noises from my front room.
Yeah, that could have been us.
Yeah,
probably was us.
Thank you, Bassus.
Sorry to disturb you.
Yes, I was trying to focus on something on BBC Four. But no, I wasn't actually. Vassos, thank you very much. Good to see you. He'll be with us every day at this time. Vassos is here Monday to Thursday at around 3:15 or thereabouts to talk sport. And if you want more on that story, you can go to thetimes.com and head to the sports section. An excellent match report from Alison Rudd on the game between Brighton and Arsenal last night. It's Times Radio, and next, our big interview is with the BAFTA-winning director behind the film This Is Endometriosis. That's next. Here are the headlines just after 3:30. James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jamie. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer's warned the conflict in the Middle East could continue for some time as he defended the government's response to the crisis. Speaking at Downing Street, the Prime Minister said he stands by his decision not to join the initial US-Israeli strikes on Iran. He also claimed Britain had been building up its defensive capability in January and February ahead of the conflict. The government is facing growing criticism after a drone hit a British base on Cyprus, while the UK still has no naval ships in the region. The Times' policy editor Oliver Wright says the Prime Minister is coming under pressure from both sides.
Starmer has made his position reasonably clear, and this kind of war isn't popular within the Labour Party. But, you know, if he wants to be a figure on the world stage, if he wants Britain to carry weight, then he needs to show that he is willing to step up.
The PM also revealed the government's first charter flight for British nationals stranded in the Middle East has now departed from Oman. Elsewhere, failed asylum seekers could be offered tens of thousands of pounds to leave the UK under plans announced by the Home Secretary. The new rules would also see taxpayer-funded support removed from those who work illegally or break the law. The UK Health Security Agency says it's investigating more than 60 cases of babies falling ill after consuming baby formula. Nestle and Danone recalled dozens of batches of certain formulas in January over concerns about toxic contamination. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Peter and Patrick are identical twins, until suddenly, at the age of 35, they weren't. Patrick was diagnosed with dilated cardiomyopathy, a rare inherited heart condition. So he was referred to Professor William McKenna's specialist team at University College Hospital and went on to have the heart transplant that eventually saved his life. But then, Peter, his identical twin, developed exactly the same symptoms caused by the same condition. He too needed an urgent heart transplant, and he too was able to have one. 20 years later, they took part in BHF's London to Brighton Cycle Challenge on a tandem, celebrating the 20th anniversary of their transplant and getting their lives back so that they could once again be identical twins. Peter and Patrick survived, but many don't. British Heart Foundation is funding research to cure inherited heart disease so that they can help more people survive. When you donate to British Heart Foundation, you're helping to fund life-saving research. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. There's over 80 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wickes.co.uk.
And some Arsenal fans have been in touch, perhaps predictably. Nigel says, Vassos says Arsenal have scored most of their goals from set pieces this season, 21. Actually, that's 21 out of 59, which is about a third, not most. Sorry for being a pedant and a gooner. And David says, what a hater of Arsenal and a complete misrepresentation of the game last night. Kate says, as an Arsenal fan, I don't care what other teams think of them. We just want to win the league. OK, well, you're going about it in a very underwhelming fashion, but best of British. Now, when the Mexican government took down a drug lord last week, the Sunday Times was there to document the aftermath. South America's correspondent Louise Callahan spoke to special forces officers with knowledge of the operation that killed Jalisco cartel leader El Mencho and to families who were destroyed by his cartel. Does this mark some sort of turning point in the war on drugs, or are things actually about to get even worse? Louise laid out the possible scenarios with Rosie Wright in today's edition of The Story podcast.
So I think the one that people are most worried about would be a succession battle. So that would be factions within the Jalisco cartel battling for supremacy, you know, splintering. Given that the cartel operates on this kind of franchise model, then there are lots of different, basically discrete groups. Is one of them going to try and push the others out and take over? I mean, when the leader of the Sinaloa cartel was captured in 2024, there was a civil war that began within the cartel, destabilizing the area massively and also leading to the Jalisco cartel being able to take a lot more power. Is something similar going to happen now? I think just because it hasn't happened in the first week doesn't mean that it can't happen in the coming months.
So the fear actually is the violent act of taking him out generates more violence, actually, as more people grapple and fight for control at the top.
Right, exactly. There's also a possibility that a rival cartel might try and push into Jalisco territory. There's also the possibility that the heads of the kind of factions within the Jalisco cartel come to some kind of agreement, say, okay, look, we'll control different areas, we'll control different routes. I think that's very much what a lot of people that I spoke to in Guadalajara is hoping will happen, that they'll find some kind of accommodation within the cartel.
Yeah. So, I mean, the operations of the cartel, how materially damaged will they be? Does this actually engineer the outcome, which is saying we take out the sort of chief drug lord, we'll stop the drugs operations?
I would say that killing El Mencho has not had any day-to-day impact on the operations of the Jalisco cartel. There's no reason why they can't keep smuggling drugs, why they can't keep their operations going with El Mencho dead. Maybe it'll have a bigger effect in the long term, but I think in the short term, you know, they have these systems, they work, they're functioning pretty much as they were before.
That is Louise Callahan talking to Rosie Wright. That was an extract from today's edition of The Story podcast. Make sure you listen to that. You can get The Story wherever you get your podcast from. It's also the place to find Off Air with Jane and Fee. And as I did briefly mention earlier, there is a bonus edition tomorrow, which is a longer version of the conversation you heard a little bit of earlier with Helen Rombolo, the brilliant Times features writer, about the pernicious influence of pornography. So that will be available tomorrow. The traditional episode of Off Air with Jane and Fee comes your way after 6 o'clock tonight. Now, there was lots of action at this year's BAFTAs. And one thing you might have missed is that the Short Film Award went to a film about a condition that almost certainly affects somebody you know. 1 in 10 women suffer from endometriosis. It can land somebody in hospital, it has no cure, it limits lives, and it's often the cause of infertility. The severe pain of it has been likened to the final stages of labour. Georgie Wildman won a BAFTA for her film about her experience of endometriosis. It is an art house triumph about pain, hope, and the years lost to treatments. At one point, Georgie was in a wheelchair because of endometriosis. She had to have a hysterectomy at 29. Fee asked Georgie whether the BAFTA win came as a surprise.
It was a strange moment. We had me and Matt both kind of said the same thing afterwards, that when they called it, we both have this feeling of like, no, this is right. I think we may well win this. And also when it happened, we were like, how on earth is this happening? It was a strange mixture of both somehow. But it really felt like the moment for the community that it was due.
Well, congratulations to you. And I can see in the background of your shot, the BAFTA award, that mask, that golden mask is lurking by a pot plant and very, very few people can have that as an ornament in their living room. Now, let's talk about the importance of this short film. Tell us a little bit about the condition endometriosis, what it actually is, what its evil cousin adenomyosis is, what it actually means.
Absolutely. So there is a vast amount of misinformation about endometriosis and adenomyosis out in the media, in the medical field, everywhere. So a big part of what we wanted to do was to try and show the reality of the disease. And that's what the This Is Endometriosis work has tried to be from the beginning. So endometriosis is often described as a condition of painful periods. And it just that cannot summarize what it is, and in the slightest, it's quite an insult actually to what the community has to fight. So it is a disease where cells similar to the lining of the uterus, not the same, grow elsewhere in the body. Those lesions then bleed, and the blood has nowhere to go. So it's internal bleeding, which will then cause can cause scarring. It can cause organs to stick and fuse together. It can damage or destroy organs completely. It is a condition of chronic pain, chronic inflammation. And with that attack on the body, you often see chronic fatigue. You see digestive issues, bladder issues. It depends where the disease is growing. So for me, I'm currently been having a lot of problems with my heart and my lung. And that pain is cyclical. So we think that there is endometriosis around my heart and my lung, and I'm waiting for my next surgery. So the symptoms will vary depending on where the disease is and how aggressively it's attacking the body.
And Georgie, what you said at the beginning is just so important, isn't it? I mean, it really isn't painful periods. And quite often when people talk about painful periods, they'll put the word just in front of it. It's just painful periods. And as you've outlined, this is a really serious condition that affects people's lives enormously. And I wonder whether you can just tell us a little bit more about what it actually feels like in terms of the symptoms.
It is quite a hard one to describe. I've been speaking about it with our producer, Harriet, about the disassociation that happens when you're in that severity of pain, which can make it quite difficult to explain it afterwards. But endometriosis is a cyclical disease. So for many of us, the worst pain that we'll experience is during our period. So I've had a hysterectomy for adenomyosis, which, as you say, is the evil cousin of endometriosis, where a similar lining, cells similar to the uterine lining grow into the wall of the uterus.
Personally, Georgie, yeah. I think it's one of the huge problems of the disease. You know, my pain would be different to your pain. Your pain would be different to another woman's pain. But it's important to try and understand what it actually means to a life, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the cyclical pain that we can have during our period is known to be commonly worse than childbirth in its severity. And it comes in waves for me, like contractions. So it looks that way to the outside, that's what's happening. And the pain throughout the rest of the month, I mean, it depends on the person and where the disease is. But for me, that's like lower back pain. It's like chest and heart pain. It's bladder pain, pain when I eat, pain when I cough. You can get random lightning pains, like sneezing without guarding first can be very dangerous. Missing a step, I mean, things like that can put you in A&E just all of a sudden because the severity of the pain that can happen. So, and it really is a full body disease. It attacks the full body. So, you know, today I've been having what I call endo flu symptoms, which is it feels like flu, but it's not. It's a fun extra of endo and the body trying to fight that inflammation and the reaction of that.
Is it understood, Georgie, why some women do suffer so badly from it?
It's not understood. And the funding we have for research is absolutely inadequate. We've hardly got any money for funding. And we still don't know why, you know, there's still no cure. And we still don't know why someone with a very small amount of disease in their body may have to use a walker or a wheelchair because of the severity of the pain. And someone who could have a fully frozen pelvis, which is where all of the organs in your pelvis are stuck together, and they may not even know they have endometriosis until they're struggling to get pregnant. So the severity of the spread of disease and the severity of pain do not correlate whatsoever. And we don't know why that is. And we really need more research to try and understand this disease.
What's been your experience of doctors treating it?
It has been very difficult. I have been quite honest about the fact that I've developed CPTSD, and an awful lot of my triggers are medical related. It has been a real fight to get diagnosed and to have my pain acknowledged and my symptoms acknowledged. It was put down to mental health for most of my childhood and my 20s. When I finally did get my diagnosis, it has been easier in some ways, but also not. I mean, the spread of misinformation about endometriosis makes it still a struggle every day. I mean, I was told not long ago by a GP, like, you don't have endometriosis anymore because you've had a hysterectomy, and I had to try and explain that that is not true. And the education for endometriosis is wrong. Like, we've got so much for people to understand. So even with a diagnosis, it's a real fight to try and get treatment and to try and be taken seriously.
And why has it become, and has it always been, in fact, such a gaslit condition? I mean, you know, the simple fact staring us in the face as we have this conversation is because women's pain and women's gynecological pain throughout history has been something that we've been told we will get, we will suffer, and we will endure. Is that the problem within the medical profession?
Absolutely. I think an awful lot of the issue is medical misogyny. Endometriosis affects women, trans men and non-binary folk. And historically, we are not treated well when we're in pain when it comes to the medical field. And but the bigger issue I feel like with this is the misinformation about endometriosis and the lack of correct education in medical schools. So if people are being trained that this is a condition of painful periods and they have very limited information on what the disease actually is, if they then see someone in A&E who physically cannot cope with the level of pain they're in, the only thing they come down to is this is a mental health issue. And we see that time and time and time again in our community.
What are the treatments available?
So we have a very long way to go. At the moment, what is known to be our best kind of option is excision surgery, which is very different to ablation surgery, which is the standard treatment offered. We see kind of hormonal treatments being given out, but these very much are a band-aid. The disease is continuing to spread and grow and cause damage with that band-aid. You know, holistically, lifestyle changes. Stress is one of the biggest triggers for chronic diseases. But we really need research because, yeah, the best we have at the moment is excision surgery, which is, you know, I've had excision surgery. I'm still very sick. There is still a lot of reoccurrence with that. And excision surgery is not accessible. It takes an awful lot of money or a very advanced case in the UK to be able to see that an excision specialist, and everyone should have access to that.
Do you know how many women do suffer from both these conditions?
From both, I don't personally know. I know that endometriosis, the last kind of chat around that, is 1 in 10 assigned female at birth, but then I've seen other chat of people saying maybe it's 1 in 5, maybe, you know, we don't know. And the fact is we have such a huge proportion of our community is undiagnosed. It takes 8 to 10 years to get a diagnosis. And even people who are having diagnostic surgeries, the GYNs who are doing those surgeries aren't trained to really know what endometriosis looks like in all its forms and to be able to find it properly. So many people are having diagnostic surgeries, being told they don't have endometriosis when they actually do. So it's a number we're not able to know at the moment.
If you'd had better treatment when you were much younger, would that have made a substantial difference to your outcomes?
Yeah. Yeah, the longer that the disease is left, the more likely we are to see comorbidities with that disease and other chronic conditions, because I've spent so much of my life in fight or flight, in extreme chronic pain, disassociating, developing CPTSD. It's like a very high stress environment for the body, and it makes you incredibly sick. And the longer it's left, the more damage can be done to your organs. The more it will affect your fertility. So it is, the longer we're leaving people, the sicker they're getting and the worse it is for their mental health to cope with this level of pain and to not be believed in that level of pain.
Why did you want to make a film?
So I had originally made a photographic project, which was the first time that the reality of endometriosis was actually being portrayed accurately in the media. And but there's only so much a photograph can show. And I think the importance of the nature of endometriosis and how so many of us can look like we're able-bodied on one day and then can be bedbound and look like we're terminally ill on the next day, that's a very important thing for people to understand, because I think that often plays into us being not believed, because we get that, well, you could do it yesterday. So
it's a very beautiful film, Georgie, and congratulations on it. I think the thing that really struck me, and presumably this is the force of your creativity here, the beautiful, really heartwarming pictures and home videos at the beginning of you as a very young child, which obviously just changes when you hit puberty, doesn't it? The innocence and the bouncy joy just has gone, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think our editor and co-director, Matt Houghton, did a beautiful job going through the archive and finding the right pieces to bring that kind of that cyclical nature of the disease into the film, and bringing that whole picture of what life with it is really like. And I think it was important as well that we also covered my grief at having to have a hysterectomy for adenomyosis at 29, when I wasn't able to have any children before that. I think it was important to tie in the childhood footage and show the impact of that on a larger scale.
Yeah. It's a beautiful film. I would recommend everybody giving it a watch. Even if you don't suffer from these diseases, you will know somebody who does. That's the point, isn't it? And you may not have understood quite what it has meant to their life that they have this.
Absolutely. It was something we were very conscious of when we were making the film, that we deliberately wanted to build our team of not just people with endometriosis, because we need this film to reach everybody, to be able to help people with endometriosis. We need everyone to see it. We need the public opinion of endometriosis to change. We need the medical opinion of endometriosis to change. So, you know, our team is comprised of a mix of people that some hadn't heard of endometriosis before and others have lived with it their whole lives. And I think what we've ended up with is a film that is reaching everyone. And I think the BAFTA win is a good sign of that, that we're doing, that what we've tried to set out for, we're achieving.
Well, that is Georgie Wildman, the BAFTA award-winning Georgie Wildman, I should say. And her film is called This Is Endometriosis. It is 6 minutes now to 4 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio, Market Watch, in association with FNC Investment Trust. Listen to Times Radio to hear all the latest financial news from all the global stock markets. Get insight, analysis, and up-to-the-minute information to help you get the most from your investment portfolio. Times Radio, Market Watch. Throughout the day, every Monday to Friday, on Times Radio, in association with FNC. It's smart to start with FNC. Find out more at fnc.com. Capital at risk.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Ah, Daniel, out of all your decisions lately, choosing Avanti West Coast First Class is by far your best. Peace and space to work, and that service. You don't have to find the coffee finds you. Oh, what's that? The smell of bacon and success, Daniel. Success.
Arrive ready with Avanti West Coast First Class. Enjoy delicious, freshly prepared food and drink and service to your seat. Some journeys belong in first class. Book direct with Avanti West Coast. Exclusions and limitations apply.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrand and Patrick Maguire.
Only a very small handful of the people that I go out for lunch with will actually want to have a glass of wine. Nigel Farage is definitely one of them.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
The Wix Peacock Awards on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
Well, we have been asking for your proudest moment of the week, your proudest of peacock moments, to be in with a chance of winning that £250 Wix voucher. We've had some cracking entries, as ever, this week. It's the last one. It's the last one today. I just wanted to mention Deborah, who says, I'm immensely proud of my son, son-in-law, and godfather to our granddaughter Lenny. They're currently on day two of a 200-kilometre march in the Brecon Beacons over 3 days to raise money for life-saving treatment for Lenny. Lenny was diagnosed with Sanfilippo syndrome, also known as childhood dementia, just before her second birthday. It is devastating. Without treatment, she will lose so, so much. I'd never heard of that. It is, you're absolutely right, Deborah, a devastating diagnosis from the sound of things. I just want to wish everybody involved with that charity march across the Brecon Beacons the very, very best of British. And I really do hope you raise a ton of money. Wanted to mention Jess as well. I'd like to nominate my partner Carl and myself. We're about to exchange on our first home. We're so proud of ourselves and all the budgeting and all the saving has paid off. We'd love to win the Wix voucher to help with the decorating in our new home. Oh, I'm very tempted, but you're not quite the winners. You're not quite, but congratulations though, and I hope your new home properly delivers. The winner this week, the final winner of Proud as a Peacock, is Corinne Kay. I am nominating my sister Jerry Lazarus. I had a wooden garden table from our late mum, which had seen better days. But I took it as it brought back so many happy memories of us all enjoying summers together as a family. And the last time my sister, Jerry, came over, she took the whole thing to pieces and rebuilt it so we could keep on using it and keep on remembering our lovely mum. And I think Jerry deserves a prize for that. She can go down to Wix and have a splurge, have a 250 quid splurge on you, Corinne, who you're kind enough and generous enough to contact us and tell us about your sister. I hope she enjoys it. Thank you to everybody who took part. And that's it. That is it from the Proud as a Peacock Wix Awards.
The Wix Peacock Awards on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
It's worth saying that John Pienaar joins you here on Times Radio from 4. In fact, he's just walked into the studio. John, can you just remind us who you've got between 6 and 7? And you're going to take questions, aren't you, on the situation in Iran?
I'm keen to get questions. We're talking about Iran and the crisis surrounding all of that. So I've got on the show in the last hour of the programme, John Sawyers, who's the former head of MI6. I've got John Bolton, the former national security advisor and to Donald Trump and a former ambassador a little bit earlier on. I'm going to be talking to the Foreign Office Minister, Hamish Falconer. I've heard from a colonel, former commander of the Argyle Regiment, who thinks the British Army should be more deeply involved, thinks that Britain's pulling its punches. We'll hear from him too. So many things. But I do want to hear what people want to hear. I want to hear what the questions they want to see asked. So send us a text, send us a tweet, the normal way.
Yeah, absolutely. And the email address, if you want to get a question into John and his panel, that way, studio@times.radio. John's with you then in a couple of seconds' time. I want to thank my producer today, Rosie Cutler, and the technical operator was Ryan Boyden. And John is next. Have a very good and I hope peaceful couple of days. We're back on Monday.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. The Prime Minister says he's focused on providing calm, level-headed leadership in the national interest as he defended the government's response to the crisis in the Middle East. And the Home Secretary has announced changes to the immigration system, which will see some families offered up to £40,000 to leave the UK. And coming up, we're going to be hearing from the Minister for the Middle East and North Africa, that's Hamish Falconer. And later on, I'm going to be joined by a host of experts, including Times World Affairs editor Catherine Philp and the host of The Story, Manveen Rana. We are going to focus very hard on the Middle East in the last hour of the programme and through the programme. I'm going to hear your questions and your texts.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister's warned the conflict in the Middle East could continue for some time as he defended the government's response to the crisis. Speaking at Downing Street, Keir Starmer said he stands by his decision not to join the initial US-Israeli strikes on Iran. He also claimed Britain had been building up its defensive capability in January and February ahead of the conflict. The government is facing growing criticism after a drone hit a British base on Cyprus, while the UK still has no naval ships in the region. The PM confirmed the first charter flight to bring UK citizens home has now taken off from Oman, while 4,000 have already returned. He said the operation to repatriate tens of thousands of British nationals was a huge undertaking.
It's one of the biggest operations of its kind, many times bigger than the evacuation from Afghanistan. It's not going to happen overnight, but we will not stop until our people are safe.
Responding to a question from The Times, the Prime Minister insisted the UK-US special relationship is in operation after he was criticised by President Trump for his response to the conflict. Explosions have been heard across Tehran on the sixth day of US-Israeli strikes. In the past few moments, the UAE says its air defences are responding to incoming Iranian missile and drone threats. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, the IDF has told residents in southern parts of Beirut to save their lives and evacuate their homes immediately. Elsewhere, the Home Secretary is proposing changes to the immigration system, which will see some families offered up to £40,000 to leave the UK. Accommodation and financial support will be removed from asylum seekers who are caught working illegally under a new conditional offer of support. Another proposal is to remove study visas from migrants from four countries where abuse is prevalent. Times Radio's political editor Anna Mihailova asked Shabana Mahmood whether the reforms inspired by policies in Denmark were compatible with Britain's growing welfare state. The Home Secretary insisted Labour was restoring control.
In large parts of our system, you know, if you've made yourself intentionally homeless, for example, a local authority does not have to house you. If you're breaking other rules and conditions of support from the state, you don't receive all of those benefits from the state. It's right that we transpose the same thinking into our asylum support system, because at the moment, once you put in an application for asylum, we're pretty much supporting everybody.
The husband of a Labour MP and two other men have been released on bail after being arrested on suspicion of spying for China. David Taylor, who's married to East Kilbride MP Joni Reid, is accused of assisting a foreign intelligence service. Head of Counter-Terrorism Policing London has previously said the force does not believe there's any imminent or direct threat. But the former Conservative Security Minister, Tom Tugendhat, is urging the government to do more.
We left them with the National Security Act, with the FERS enhanced scheme that they could have put China on, and they haven't done any of it. This is no time for concerns. I'm not interested in their concerns. I want to see them protecting Britain, protecting Parliament, and protecting the right of British people to choose who governs them.
For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. Thanks for joining me. We have just been listening to Keir Starmer telling us he stands by his decision not to join the attack on Iran and Iran's leaders, and that he stands by that, which puts him in an awkward spot, at least where the much overblown special relationship is concerned. Donald Trump's war in Iran, and it is fair to call it that, since he is keen to claim full ownership of this war himself. The war has shaken the global economy. It's raised huge questions over the stability of the Middle East, and it's left America's allies in Europe and the world scrambling to find their feet. And no one, arguably, much more than Keir Starmer, Britain's Prime Minister, has suddenly been transformed from one of Trump's closest friends and allies to being near the top of the list of friends and allies the President likes to abuse. Leave aside for a moment that Keir Starmer is obviously, well, no one's idea of Winston Churchill, including presumably his own. The PM won cheers and support from Labour MPs for refusing to endorse a war he said lacked legal authority or even a plan. And whether you agreed with him on that or not, it looked as if his leadership to his own side and quittings of Starmership had taken a bit of a boost. Now, what a blow then to the Prime Minister to see reporting in The Spectator that he was willing to consider helping America strike at Iran from British bases before the idea was shot down by senior cabinet colleagues, from Ed Miliband and Angela Rayner on the left to Shabana Mahmood on his right. Could it be true that Keir Starmer was cornered into his position on Iran? Did he paradoxically take a strong leadership line because he was made to? The Prime Minister gave a news conference earlier this afternoon. We're going to be talking about that and hopefully talking to you. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times. Tell me what you think. And later on, I'm going to be really looking forward to talking live to one of this country's greatest historians on warfare and its effects. That is Sir Anthony Beaver. Firstly, let's just have a listen back. Downing Street this afternoon, the Prime Minister saying he stands by his decision not to join the initial US-Israeli strike on Iran. PM saying Britain had been building up its defensive capability since January.
We started pre-deploying in January and February our assets to the region to make sure that we had the capability that we needed there. That wasn't an isolated set of decisions. It was done in conjunction with the US, in conjunction with our allies, and we're bolstering that again. And therefore, I can say we're doing everything and have done everything we can at speed to make sure that we are properly protecting our citizens, which was my number one concern. And that's why it's very important that I set out the pre-deployment measures that we took.
And the Prime Minister told the Times that the special relationship was still alive after fierce criticism from President Trump.
Look, the special relationship is in operation right now. We're working with the Americans in the deployment from our bases. We are working together in the region, the US and the British working together to protect both the US and the British in joint bases where we're jointly located. And we're sharing intelligence on 24/7 basis in the usual way. That is the special relationship. That is a special relationship in operation. And clearly it's for the president to take decisions that he considers in the national interest, the right decisions for the US. I understand that. I respect that. But equally, it's for me as the British Prime Minister to take decisions that I consider to be in the best interest of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, so sort of a gentle form of defiance. It was a British leader taking decisions for Britain in Britain's interest. Oliver Wright is the Times